Session number 9956.
Michael Owen, Reel 2. You were put up at the Sackville Court Hotel.
Yes.
What sort of conditions were you living under there? Not too bad, I suppose.
Very good. The food was excellent. We were put into a single room. There was another officer and myself. This other officer, no name's no Patro, he was a son of a very wealthy man, a shipbuilder. And he used to drink highballs in the bar. I couldn't afford this. And so I used to go along to Brighton and drink there. But the food was excellent, excellent. And in the ship, too, in this stone frigate, HMS King Alfred, it was very good.
What would a rough daily routine be during this training period as a midshipman?
That's a hard question. I would think we would start at a reasonable hour, I would believe, probably 9 o'clock, I would imagine. No. We would have breakfast in King Alfred. That's right. And if I remember rightly, we would then have the parade and then the usual routine, except we did on one occasion go to a yacht owned by Sopwith, and that was at New Haven, and the name of the yacht was Philante, if I can remember rightly, and we had to go out and do practical navigation, and we were all sick as hell. A beautiful yacht. I think it's still in existence today.
Is that Sopwith, the manufacturer,
yes,
aircraft?
Yes. It was his yacht, the Philante. And that, we had practical experience there.
What made you sick? Because you'd been at sea a lot.
Oh, yes, but I mean, I used to be terribly seasick, even later on in the war. Joining Lowestoft, I'd be sick for probably 4 or 5 weeks, and then I'd get used to it. Permanently at sea. But if you weren't at sea the whole time, you could be, of course.
So you'd do this, you'd have a morning session of training. Of the same
signals,
sort as we
yes, that's right.
Discussed at the Callier.
Yes.
And then a midday meal.
Yes.
And then another session in the afternoon.
Oh, yes, and in the evening, too.
So three sessions.
Oh, yes. It was really, I think it was Creed, I don't know. He was a very, very fine commander who looked after us, very fine. But let me tell you, of the 18, I passed out second bottom. I didn't probably take it as seriously as I should have done. I enjoyed life. I used to go along dancing at Brighton. My friend who passed out bottom, he was a great man, great chap, he was the son of the Provost of Edinburgh or Glasgow, and he also was killed, in the Norwegian campaign. Great loss.
So you'd have the evening free after the evening session.
Yes.
About what time would you be free to go out then?
I wouldn't know. I would think probably 7 o'clock or something like that. I would think so. And then, of course, you had the concerts where Peter Scott, as I say, was great on his repartee. He was very first class.
What did he specialise in?
Yankee Doodle Dandy's singing. He would have a violin, or he was a great raconteur as well. Great man. Yes.
You say you're at the end of it, you passed out second. That implies you had some
second bottom.
Second bottom.
Yes.
Sorry,
yes,
that's what
yes,
I meant.
Yes.
How did how were you assessed? What was the nature of the examinations that you had?
Oh, you were really pushed through in every way. I mean, in signals, in navigation, in marching and that sort of thing. Oh, yes.
Drill.
Drill, yes. Seamanship.
Was it more, as you imply, that you weren't concentrating fully on what was on it, rather than, or were you having trouble with some of them besides navigation?
Well, I don't know. I think it was a tough. I don't know how many were rejected in those days. I think we were fairly important. I don't think many were. But for some reason or other, I was sent to this HMS Lowestoft, which was a great appointment. But I think I was second bottom. I may have been third.
So, and you passed out. What happened when you passed out then?
Well, that I always remember because some officers were sent to do an ASDIC course, and four or five of us, were sent to the Rosyth Escort Force. And I well remember going up to London and staying at the Dorchester Hotel, would it be the Cumberland Hotel. We had hardly any money, and one of my pals and I, we took this room. It was 30 bob for, I didn't realize, bed and breakfast, and we went to see The Little Dog Laughs, Flanagan and Allegan, Flanagan and the other,
Alan,
at the London Palladium, where they sang Run, Rabbit, Run. It was a very good show. I remember very well coming back, and my friend stayed in bed and said, I'm ordering my breakfast, and I thought I'd be much cheaper, and so I went down below some cafe, had a cheap breakfast, and when I came to pay my bill, I only realized it was a bed and breakfast, so, you know, I missed out. We went north to Rosyth. No, totally wrong. Rosyth Escort Force we were going to, but I had to go join my ship, Lowestoft. Some went to join up north. I went from London to Devonport, to join HMS Lowestoft. She had arrived in from the China station. Now, this was in February 1940, and it was at the time when HMS Exeter, in the River Plate battle, was welcomed home to Devonport, because I remember seeing the HMS Exeter come in damaged, and Winston Churchill was down there at that time. At that stage, I was the only RNVR, or hostility only, officer or rating to join the ship.
And you were now a sub-lieutenant?
No, I was still a midshipman. I was a midshipman until the 1st of March 1940. Now, on arrival at the ship by taxi, because it was a done thing to arrive by taxi, there was a civilian coming off, and it happened to be the commanding officer, A.M. Knapp was his name. Some ratings called him P.M. Cork, which meant A.M. Knapp to go to sleep, and P.M. Cork was to sleep as well. So anyway, he said, he invited me down to the wardroom, and it was a sloop, it was only 1,500 tons, if that. And he asked me, would I have a drink? And he said, suggested a gimlet, which was a gin and lime, which I thoroughly enjoyed. It was threepence. And at the end of the month, I will remember very well, he called me into his cabin, and he said, your wine bill is stopped. He said, midshipmen are not allowed to drink gin. But he'd suggested it, and I was the only midshipman in the ship. It was bloody stupid. Quite absurd, but he was a tough character, A.M. Knapp, very tough.
Did that sort of discipline, did that rile a bit?
Oh yes, it did, but one had to accept it. In fact, discipline was extremely tough. I was given the job as officer of the watch, and they took out the ship's writer, who was a petty officer, and I became the ship's writer or secretary to the captain.
Well, no, so that's two sets of duties in a sense.
Two sets of duties, and also decoding, ciphering.
So let's take each one of those in turn. Mm. As officer of the watch, could you just for us run through, when you did that, what your duties would be?
Well, you would be under the officer of the watch, and I suppose in studying him, we of course zigzagged in convoy. So you would take over on that score, you would alter in course, you would, as second officer watch, you'd do the rounds at night time to see that everybody was asleep down below and that everything was correct down below, and you'd go around the guns to see nobody was asleep. It was a routine. And you'd learn navigation as well under the officer of the watch.
Were you allowed to take control of the ship at all as a midshipman?
No, not at night time and daytime. Yes, but not... Well, when you say take control, you mean officer of the watch without your senior being present? No, you weren't. No, not until later on.
So you'd be allowed to give commands, but only if someone was behind you?
That's right, yes.
Were you looking forward to the responsibility of actually becoming a real officer of the watch?
A bit terrifying, but yes, I suppose so, yes, indeed.
Now, you also had to, you said you had to act as ship's writer. Well, explain exactly what that involved.
Well, as ship's secretary, possibly, to the captain. In convoy, it was my job to make notes of all alterations of course, enemy action, anything untoward that happened. And at the end of the convoy, which at that stage was from Rosyth to the Thames and back, that's before we went into the Atlantic, I would type it out. I'd present it to the captain in my handwriting. He would alter it, and then I would type it out, and then we'd put it onto these blue jellies. Carbon paper. You had to do your copies on blue jelly. It was quite a task too.
How did that work?
Yes.
I don't know what that is at all.
Well, you type out your once the report had been approved, you type it out, and this was on some backing, which was blue jelly. You put this backing onto blue jelly, and you could take copies off. It was quite a tedious task. I've got copies upstairs of all the reports, a lot of them.
Were there any other duties that you had to do?
When I say decoding, ciphering signals, the doctor was always the surgeon was always the surgeon lieutenant, principal medical officer. Well, there was only one. Would do the, if any signals came in by cipher, he and I would do that together.
You didn't have a code in seaman,
No. He had the codes, and we used to do it together.
You'd only get the very simple ones at that size ship anyway.
Yes. But at that stage, what one didn't know, and I think it's really frightening now, one does know that the B. Dienst had broken our code, of course, as you know. The B. Dienst was the German intelligence. They had broken our code, and they knew exactly what anything we sent out, they had broken it. I think it's a horrifying thought now, particularly in the Battle of the Atlantic and on East Coast.
Now, you said you were on the East Coast convoy on the lowest...
Yes.
What did that involve? Could you take me through a typical East Coast convoy?
Yes, you had a fast north and a fast south, FS and FN. The convoy would... The Rosyth escort force consisted of V&W destroyers and sloops. And this is before, and indeed after, the Norwegian campaign. We would leave Rosyth, proceed to Methil, where the ships loaded with coal would assemble, and we would then proceed south to 20 Seaboy, which is outside the Tyne, where more ships would come out of the Tyne, and then we would proceed further south. Some ships would go into the Humber, and indeed some ships would come out of the Humber, and then we would go into the Thames estuary and anchor off Sheerness, these merchant ships would go on up the Thames. This was all right because it was very restful. You could have a night in turned in. There was no officer on the bridge when we anchored off Sheerness until the Blitz started, and then of course it was really tough going because we had to man the guns as well as officer the watch and if you'd had a tough convoy, it was you got very little rest.
And what was on the routine the other way? Was it
the same sort of thing? They'd be in ballast coming north, and of course the amusing thing there was that. I never forget one ship called the Ice Maid, Commodore Newman. He was Lieutenant Commander R&R, and he liked to get into the Tyne quick on a Saturday night so he could get his beer and go home. And on this occasion, he was Commodore, and he was way ahead of the convoy. And in the afternoon watch, I reported to the captain that it was impossible, that this ship was going too fast. So he sent a signal to the ice maid reprimanding him. And he replied, which was a damn cheek, to say that he was sorry that the ice maid had been milking revolutionists whilst he'd been asleep. But he got a ticking off. The ships would go into the town, and then we would proceed up to Methil and go into Rosyth. And once a month, I don't know if it was once a month, it couldn't have been, once probably every 2 months, we had a boiler clean, which meant that you had three or 4 days off.
Now, how long would it take to go in each direction? What was the sort of frequency, and how long would it take?
I would say 2.5 days. I would say down and 2.5 days north, something like that. And then, of course, if I think the worst experience, do I tell you this, or would you? The worst experience I had, which I think was really terrible, was of a convoy which came from Rosyth or Methil. We came into the Tyne because of bad weather. And I think this must have been after Dunkirk. It would have been about July, August, after Denmark had been occupied. And I found the captain of a ship called the Monberg. I met him in Newcastle. And this captain recognized me. I had come back from France in 1937 to Newcastle. In her. She'd gone out with Cole and Danish and had come back. And I said to the captain, any news of your family? He said, no. And I felt very sorry for him. Anyway, we proceeded south. Now, I think it was Smith's Knoll, I'm not sure, but it was close to the Thames estuary. And that night, we passed this buoy. It was dark. I don't know what time of night it was. It was very dark. And we suddenly heard a revving up, and it was an E-boat. And the E-boat, in fact, and then there was a big explosion astern of us, and it was the N.C. Monberg that had blown up, and there were no survivors. They used to come, the E-boats, there was not, we had no radar in those days, but they used to come secure to the buoy and let the escort go by and then attack the and this was the Monberg, which was terrible. It affected me. That was the sort of East Coast call. And then you had air attacks, of course.
Taking just the E-boats, can you remember any other cases of E-boat attacks on the convoys while you were on?
That was the only E-boat attack that we had. We had several air attacks, but on that score, we shot down two aircraft. One was off Whitby, and it was a Heinkel 115 seaplane. There were two of them, and they had landed off Whitby on the sea, and then they would take off and try and torpedo ships in the convoy. Well, we got one of them, and we were going for survivors when the other aircraft we saw, and it took off, and we picked nobody up from the first aircraft. Then we had another convoy, which was this is on the East Coast before the Atlantic, which was a very serious one. There was a floating dock in the Tyne, which was built to go up to a Scarpa Flow so that the destroyers could be repaired in Scarpa Flow. There was no floating dock up there. And so there were a very big escort left the Tyne. There again, I think it must have been September. And the weather was good, and we were not sighted at all. We got up there, and on the way south, off the Moray Firth, we had an awful attack, because the Heinkel 111s came up at a height and bombed us. And we then, only too late, saw, a flotilla or whatever you call it, a flight of Heinkel 111s, torpedo bombers low, came into us. They sank two big ships, which was unfortunate. But also, one of the aircraft went round to the west in the Moray Firth, and we had a... I was gunner control in the control, in the control tower, and we had sights on her. All the way in, very brave man, he hadn't dropped his torpedo, and he came in, but what he didn't realise, he was silhouetted against the sun. And as he came in, the captain on the bridge ordered me to open fire. So I did, and the first shell went straight into the nacelle of this Heinkel 111, and it went into the sea, and of course they were killed. But I was so pleased to see this. The captain was yelling to me, "Cease fire, cease fire," when the guns were traversing across the bow, and eventually fired into the, to my regret, into the convoy. And I don't know whether it was a City of Dunham or the name of the ship, but I did cease fire, and the captain called me to the bridge and said he would have me up for murder because I hadn't ceased fire when he'd originally told me to do so. And if in the morning we found that there had been casualties, I was in real trouble. I had a sleepless night, but I'm pleased to say that in the morning when we went down the line, there was a hole in the side of this ship. It was in the hold, not in the passenger accommodation. And they were all cheering us because they'd seen us shoot down there, and nothing further was said.
That does actually bring us to another set of duties, which I perhaps omitted earlier. You have your action station position as opposed to your normal duties. You say you were
in the gunnery, directing the guns.
Could you explain exactly how that all worked on the boat at that time in the war?
Well, we had twin 0.4-inch guns, fore and aft, and on the captain giving the order to open fire, you press some bell and the guns fired. But in the director, my job was to look up at the aircraft or whatever it might be, the object, and to get on sight. And then there was somebody on the petty officer on the right who had the range, and he'd pass that to the guns. And then there was, of course, the transmitting station just below us on the bridge. And two combined, we would hope to have a direct hit.
So the system worked that you were actually in charge of sighting on.
That's right.
The sight.
That's right.
This other, the petty officer did the range.
Yes.
And you would transmit those to the guns.
Through the transmitting station.
Would that mean that the guns automatically went where you were pointing them?
Yes.
Or did they then align it to what you were told?
No. I think it to my knowledge at the time, I think it automatically went to the.
They'd be able to go on to manual, I presume, if they.
Yes, indeed.
Did you find this centralised gunnery direction, was that an effective method, do you think, for that size ship?
Oh, I think they were very efficient. We had a lot of armour in there, twin 0.4-inch guns. They were very effective. Mind you, again, having no clue of mathematics, I remember there was this occasion, I believe it, I'm sure of it, it was the first, no line shoot, it was the very first Stuka dive bombing attack on a convoy in the last war, and that would be just after the invasion, before Norway. There were 12 aircraft came in from the South End way at a height, and we hadn't a clue what they were. And they went into three groups of four and then dive-bombed us. And I think it was the first dive-bombing attack. But this was my own lack of knowledge. I tried to bullshit the captain. I put the report in that there was the bomb, three bombs had fell so many hundred yards to the to starboard of us. And when we got to South End, he asked me, how did I work it out? And I said I had the angle of sight through the director, I had the range, and I squared the hypotenuse, which of course didn't bullshit Captain Knapp at all. And I remember him well pressing the tit on the navigator to come to the to his cabin, and he said, "You've got to teach him sines, cosines, and tangents, and I give you 2 days to do so." So you know, it was a bit of a farce, but they were tough. They were tough, very, very tough discipline.
How many... Was that your only action station post? You would always go to that post?
Yes,
was there somebody else who did the same job when you weren't doing it? Or was it such a small ship?
Not to my knowledge. It was such a small ship. No, it was it's always myself that did that. In fact, I was in the action station when we were mined in 1941.
I'll come to that. Did you find the job of sighting easy? Were your reactions and eyes suited to
that? Oh, yes, I didn't have any difficulty on it at all.
How had you been selected for this job, or was that just the automatic position?
Oh, I think that the dog's body, I suppose I was just, I don't know, I was just told to do it.
Did you find it interesting?
Yes. But this captain, he was probably right. I remember you were talking about seasickness. I remember very well. You'd go on watch, in the morning watch, and you know you'd have an hour for breakfast. Then you would have time off. But he used to call me onto the bridge in any excuse he could to really get me toughened up. So I hated the man at the time, but at the end of the day we were good friends.
You've now been faced with enemy action. How did you react to it?
Well, I think naturally everybody, myself, I'm sure, like others, would be frightened to a degree. And then there was an excitement afterwards when it was over. and very sad when you knew that ships had been sunk and that people had lost their lives. But... yes, I think one was, particularly later on in the war, not so much in 1940, but later on.
So it got worse?
Oh yes, I had the most awful, very, very frightened later on in 44, when I'd seen a ship blow up and I was sent to the sister ship, when I saw HMS Avenger blow up with a tremendous loss of life, and I was sent to the sister ship, yes.
Now, how long were you on the East Coast run for then?
Well, we were East Coast. Coast from February 40, and then we had 2 months, maybe it's a month and a half in was it September, October, November in 2 months in the Atlantic, and then the rest was on East Coast until we were mined.
Now this Atlantic period, we'll have a look at that. How were the Atlantic convoys organised as far as the lower stuff was concerned?
We were sent out from Rosyth, the HX-72 and SC-2 were the two bad convoys. We would go out about 500 to 600 miles out into the Atlantic and then escort. To my knowledge, we never escorted any convoy outward bound. We went out to escort inward. The first was HX-72, which was the very first convoy, the Wolfpack attack of the war. It was the happy days, the Germans called it. It's been written about a lot.
What do you remember in as much detail as possible about that convoy and the Wolfpack attack?
Well, my commanding officer was the senior officer of the escort.
This is Knapp.
Knapp, yes. And therefore, he was responsible for the movements of the escorts round the convoy. HX-72, into my recollection, had already 3 days and nights of attack. They had been mauled. The night that we arrived was the worst night. And this was Preen, Shepka and Kreischmeyer, who were the three aces. Preen, who sank the Royal Oak. Shepka, Preen was ultimately lost, as you know. Shepka was also lost. Preen and Shepka were lost on the same night. They were both sunk. And Kreischmeyer was rescued. They worked on the basis of going inside the convoy, which was quite unbelievable at the time from the British point of view. I believe that Dönitz had suggested that they do this. So they would go inside the convoy on the surface or trim down, and they would torpedo ships right, left and centre. And of course you heard this on the radio that they'd been torpedoed. The one ship I saw blow up was the Simla. She blew up in a sheet of flame, but you didn't always see ships blow up. You just heard them, heard of it.